Good evening and welcome to this extended Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report for March 20th, 2026. Tonight we'll hear from the City Council and Moscow Deputy City Administrator Tyler Palmer 2 days after Moscow's Paradise Creek reached the highest crest ever in 47 years of measurements. The council approved the first ever Paradise Creek maintenance plan. But first, we have some world headlines from FSN and the Public News Service, followed by a roundup of regional news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Tony Waterman. U.S. President Donald Trump has again lashed out at NATO allies, calling them cowards for not helping the U.S. open the Strait of Hormuz. FSN's Nick Harper reports from Washington.
On social media, another attack from the U.S. President Donald Trump against NATO allies, this time calling NATO a paper tiger, saying that it didn't want to join the fight to stop a nuclear-powered Iran. He said that they are complaining about high oil prices, but are unwilling to help open the Strait of Hormuz. He called them cowards, saying that he would remember. He's previously criticized the Security Alliance, saying that the US didn't need any help, now that the military action against Iran had been won. But many allies are still worried that there's no end in sight to the conflict, as shipping remains stymied and oil prices continue to rise.
The cost of the war in Iran is likely more expensive than originally thought. The Trump administration had said about $1 billion a day in taxpayer money was being spent. But a new report from the bipartisan think tank CSIS says that estimate doesn't account for infrastructure damage or combat losses, like 3 fighter jets that were shot down by Kuwaiti air defenses in a friendly fire incident at the start of the war. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says the U.S. attacks are only intensifying, and the Pentagon is now gearing up to ask Congress for an additional $200 billion in funding, a small price to pay, says President Trump. Lawmakers, though, are already pushing back, saying this is money that could be spent on domestic priorities like health care, making housing more affordable, and education. Travel chaos is spreading across the U.S. as a funding fight in Washington hits airport security lines hard and threatens to close some airports completely. FSN's Mitch McCann reports.
Airports across the U.S. are facing long queues as travelers are forced to wait hours in some cases to make their way through airport security after hundreds of TSA agents quit and many more have called out sick while they aren't being paid because of the partial shutdown. In February, the government passed a partial budget, but Democrats refused to fund the Department of Homeland Security over concerns about immigration enforcement, which is managed by DHS agencies, after a number of high-profile incidents involving agents. Earlier this week, the acting TSA deputy administrator said the high number of staff calling out sick could lead to a situation where airports have to shut down. On Friday morning, maximum wait times at George Bush International Airport in Houston were up to 200 minutes, while Atlanta's main airport had a maximum wait time of 80 minutes.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Voting rights advocates in New York and across the country are pushing back against the Save America Act in Congress. The U.S. Senate is debating the bill, which would include a strict voter ID law requiring people to use a passport or birth certificate to vote or register. But more than 5 million New Yorkers who are citizens don't have passports. Supporters say the bill would crack down on non-citizen voting, but data show this rarely occurs. Justin Kwasa with the League of Conservation Voters says instead it would create more challenges for historically disenfranchised communities.
Communities that have suffered the worst impacts of environmental injustice also traditionally haven't been allowed to be a part of the voting process in our nation's history. So in order to correctly address environmental issues, we need to have a strong democracy and we need to have these communities participate.
The bill also comes with a large financial burden. The National Association of Counties estimates implementing the Save America Act would cost 11 times more than current federal grant funding provides, and states would be responsible for picking up the tab on the bill's $510 million cost increase for elections. Despite the potential impacts of the Save America Act, polls show most Americans support voter ID laws, with a majority of states already requiring identification to vote. But not everyone has access to a birth certificate or passport, the kinds of documents required under the bill. Kwasa says the bill also contains carve-outs for certain people.
A huge argument against the Save Act is the married woman provision, where you have to have your original birth certificate, and so millions and millions of married women wouldn't qualify to register to vote because their current name does not match their birth name.
In New York, that could include as many as 3.7 million people. Even if the Save America Act doesn't pass, some individual states are leaning towards similar measures. In legislatures nationwide, more than 138 bills are being considered that would implement stricter voter ID requirements or further proof of citizenship for voting or voter registration. This is Edwin J. Vieira for New York News Connection.
The Pennsylvania Department of Education is awarding $1 million in hunger-free campus grants to 30 colleges and schools to help address student food insecurity. Now in its fourth year, the program has supported 92 institutions statewide since 2023. Carnegie Mellon University just received its fourth $60,000 grant, so its awards have totaled $240,000. Elizabeth Vaughn with Carnegie Mellon says the bulk of the hunger-free campus dollars will support a variety of food initiatives, including what's known as the Meal Swipe program, to help students who have the highest level of need.
This Meal Swipe program offers an additional resource to those students to be able to eat at our All You Care to Eat dining facility on campus, and also a secondary location that has allergen-free options.
Governor Josh Shapiro's administration has secured a total of $3 million for hunger-free campus grants in the last three state budgets. Grant recipients are using creative approaches to improve food security, from offering flexible meal plans that meet SNAP requirements to launching meal sharing programs, training student leaders, and building new community partnerships. Vaughn says a school pantry provides non-perishable food, hygiene items, and fresh produce. She notes the grant funding will also provide assessments to gauge student needs and quick meals for nutrition all through the school pantry.
So we've partnered with Chartwell's to design this frozen meal program, where we are providing frozen, ready-to-heat meals that have a higher nutritional content.
Chartwell's is the university's dining vendor. She adds Carnegie Mellon has a diverse student body, and most of the food for its campus pantry comes from the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank. Vaughn says grant funding will also support repackaging of bulk foods into smaller quantities, and they plan to hold focus groups to learn more about students' needs. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Keystone State News Connection, I'm Danielle Smith.
Indiana Governor Mike Braun is letting a major public health bill become law without his signature. It is the only measure from the 2026 session he chose not to sign. The law renews syringe service programs in six counties for 5 years, but adds new limits, including ID requirements and one-for-one needle exchanges. Indiana State Medical Association President Dr. Ryan Singerman says the programs play a key role in preventing disease.
They are effective, and ongoing studies continue to show that they reduce transmitted diseases, that they increase the amount of people going into recovery, and it does not lead to any increase in substance use.
Supporters say the programs reduce HIV and hepatitis risk and connect people to treatment. Critics, including Braun, argue they focus on symptoms instead of addiction itself. The governor says the new restrictions reflect compromises pushed during the legislative process. The syringe service programs began after a 2015 HIV outbreak in Scott County tied to needle sharing. State health data show high return rates for used syringes, though not all are collected. Dr. William Cook, who practices medicine in Scott County, says the programs remain critical in rural Indiana.
People want to do the right thing, and low barrier access enables people to take responsibility, not recklessness. Scott County demonstrates this. Before the service program opened, 74% of people reported that they used syringes used by someone else already.
The law also restricts where sites can operate and allows the state health department to shut down programs that do not comply. I'm Joe Ullery, Indiana News Service.
Illinois continues to be a hot spot for data center construction. Rural areas are next on the list, and residents are worried. Illinois has 178 data centers and 50 data center providers in major cities, according to the website datacenters.com. To meet growth demands, rural areas of the state are under the microscope for new projects. A Brookings Institution study says local rural communities would benefit from a greater focus on accessibility and duration of data center jobs. Tony Pippa with the Brookings Institution says concerns over jobs are valid, but residents also question whether the size and development of these centers are what is best for their community.
People are worried about how it will affect the quality of life and even the integrity of the places where they're living. These are really large industrial developments. They take up a lot of land. What it means for the view shed, there may be noise and light pollution.
The Brookings research points to electricity, water, and public service demands under rural systems that may already be strained as additional concerns. It says local governments generally have limited authority over prices, service demands, and environmental impacts. Pippa says this leads to a loss of ability to control, engage, and help shape what might be happening. Pippa notes the large footprint of data centers right now is a result of current technology and demand. Solutions are needed to increase productivity and efficiency and to use fewer resources to get the same or even greater output. He adds the state of technology is changing very rapidly to meet that challenge.
Chip technology, the use of water to cool. There's proposals to put data centers in space where you won't need coolants because it's cold. There's proposals to shrink data centers significantly.
Pippa expects to see technology and computing power improving at the same time the demand for usage increases. And he believes the urgent race right now is driven by markets and geopolitical forces. In the meantime, he knows the fears will continue about building massive data centers. I'm Terry D. reporting.
With the flurry of data centers and large farm expansions across Wisconsin, rural advocates are voicing concerns about what they see as a pattern of corporate extraction from their communities. The state has at least 50 data centers and more than 350 permits for concentrated animal feeding operation permits, with pending projects for both. Two of the state's AI data centers will reportedly use more energy than all of the homes in the state, according to Clean Wisconsin. And Danny Akinson with Grassroots Organizing Western Wisconsin says both industries consume millions of gallons of water and pose significant climate risks to air, land, and water quality.
These two industries are just two examples of a big corporate agenda that is extracting wealth from our communities, extracting resources, and subsidizing the costs of their operations onto community members.
Data center supporters say they're critical for economic development, job creation, and boosting the state's digital infrastructure. And CAFO operators argue there are state regulations that ensure safeguards for the environment and that expansion is necessary to meet increasing demand. As more local governments try to rein in construction of new data centers, Wisconsin lawmakers are considering ways to regulate the rapidly growing sector, including a bill to keep data center information public. Akinson stresses current state regulations for both data centers and CAFOs fail to protect communities from their negative effects and create opportunities for corporate overreach.
What we're seeing more across the state of Wisconsin is the proliferation of really these mega dairies and mega CAFOs that are squeezing small farmers out, and even family-owned CAFOs that might be 1,000 cows or 2,000. We're seeing a whole different scale.
Akinson notes this will be a critical election year in Wisconsin, and these impacts will likely become key campaign issues. He emphasizes the importance of local organizing to protect communities and stronger legislative action to address systemic problems. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
Utah conservation groups are lining up to oppose a move by the state's congressional delegation that would jeopardize the national monument status of Grand Staircase Escalante. Trump administration allies cite a recent ruling by the Government Accounting Office and have introduced a resolution to overturn the Biden-era resource management plan for the 1.9 million acre preserve. Steve Block with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance calls removing Grand Staircase Escalante from BLM management a very bad idea.
If the plan is undone through the congressional Review Act. It's not clear what plan would replace it. That's a big part of the concern. I think you'll hear from folks is that plan provides that certainty for land management.
The Congressional Review Act resolution filed 2 weeks ago by Utah Senator Mike Lee would revoke the management plan for the monument, which currently provides for recreational access, protection of cultural sites, safeguards for wildlife habitat, restrictions on off-road vehicles in sensitive areas, and more. Congress has not yet voted on the resolution. Autumn Gilliard with the Grand Staircase Intertribal Coalition says the monument is sacred to tribal nations as an ancestral homeland. He says the move bypasses tribal consultation and would remove protections for some of the area's unique resources.
With this imposition of the CRA, it would leave many cultural resources and environmental resources open for harm. When management frameworks are dismantled, it affects cultural survival and spiritual continuity for Indigenous people.
Other groups opposing the move include the National Parks Conservation Association, Sierra Club, National Wildlife Federation, and others. It's the latest move in a long-standing battle over the monument, which was reduced in size during President Donald Trump's first term in 2017 before being restored by President Joe Biden in 2021. For Utah News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson.
A judge is allowing local and statewide conservation groups to intervene in a lawsuit in order to defend Chuckwalla National Monument. An off-road group based in Idaho and a miner from Michigan have sued the U.S. Department of the Interior, seeking to strip protections from the National Monument located in the Desert Mountains, 80 miles east of Palm Springs. Colin Barrows is with the nonprofit Cactus to Cloud Institute in La Quinta, one of the interveners in the lawsuit. He says Chuckwalla is significant to 13 tribal nations.
There's a lot of World War II and mining history in the area, that, and then rare species that have found nowhere else on Earth. You've got endangered desert tortoises, bighorn sheep, hundreds of species of plants and animals.
President Joe Biden used the Antiquities Act to confer national monument status on Chuckwalla weeks before leaving office. The area includes the Orocopia Mountains, which means plentiful gold, but locals say there's very little gold to be found there. The name was just a long-ago marketing ploy to attract residents and miners. Barrows says the Trump administration's focus on extracting commercial value from public lands is misguided.
Morally and financially, there's much more value in protecting public lands for recreation access, for clean air and water, tribal values, than there is in stripping of whatever minerals might be there and then having it be a wasteland forever after.
He adds the off-highway vehicle paths that crisscross the monument are maintained by staff when they wash out during periodic flash floods. Other groups intervening in the lawsuit include the Conservation Lands Foundation, the National Parks Conservation Association, and the Sierra Club. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Vehicle collisions kill endangered Florida panthers and other forms of wildlife and cost the nation billions annually. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission reports 4 panther deaths on state roads so far this year. Last year, 18 panthers died, all but one by vehicle. A federal wildlife crossing pilot program set to expire in September has already funded a project along U.S. 27 in Highlands County, a known hotspot where panthers and black bears are often hit. Sarah Gledhill with the Florida Wildlife Federation says after 2 years of effort and an initial rejection in the competitive application process, the funding came through.
FDOT reapplied for that funding. We supported it along with a number of other state agencies and conservation organizations, and the state got the money, and they received $6.1 million for a new wildlife crossing.
What's known as the Venus Crossing will connect roughly 90,000 acres of conservation land. The national pilot program was created in 2021 with $350 million and will expire this fall unless Congress acts. Supporters say it saves lives of people and animals and reduces costly collisions. Critics question the federal spending and whether states should shoulder more responsibility. Mike Leahy at the National Wildlife Federation says wildlife vehicle collisions are a major problem nationwide, costing more than $8 billion a year and causing about 26,000 injuries and hundreds of human deaths each year.
The Wildlife Crossings Program makes sure that money is available to reduce wildlife vehicle collisions in these areas
save human lives, save wildlife lives, and also help wildlife move around the state and around the country.
Leahy notes that without reauthorization, many projects will be delayed or never completed. Both the House and Senate versions of the reauthorization bill await action in congressional committees. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
KFB, Moscow is the best in the USA. Yeah.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Idaho House is considering a measure to give the Attorney General power to disqualify local elected officials for violating state law. The bill, co-sponsored by House Speaker Mike Moyle of Star, comes months after the city of Boise declared the LGBTQ flag an official flag of the city to get around a state ban targeting gay pride flags. According to the Idaho Capital Sun, House Bill 896 would permit Attorney General Raul Labrador to temporarily disqualify local elected officials and other government employees if they are found to be willfully violating state laws. The bill would allow Labrador to sue a government agency, official, or employee after his or her office issues a warning if they do not correct the alleged violation of state law. The bill's co-sponsor is Representative John Schertz of Weezer. He presented the bill for Speaker Moyle. House Minority Leader Elena Rubel of Boise asked if the city of Boise's flag workaround was the inspiration behind House Bill 896. Schertz said, "It's a broader issue. I don't think it's something we should shy away from, right? If there's a law that needs to be followed, it should be followed." The bill would provide exemptions for judges and state lawmakers from these state lawsuits. The war in Iran has pushed gas prices above $4 a gallon in the Lewiston-Clarkston Valley and up to $4.09 per gallon on the Palouse. Global oil markets have increased the cost of gas in Idaho by more than a dollar for 1 gallon in the past month. Crude oil rose to $119 a barrel, though it fell slightly on Thursday evening. According to the Lewiston Tribune, American Automobile Association Idaho Public Affairs Director Matthew Condi wrote in a news release, "Every state in the union is suffering the same fate, soaring gas prices as a result of the conflict in the Middle East. With 20% of the global oil supply no longer flowing through the Strait of Hormuz, we continue to see enormous pressure on crude prices and, in turn, gas prices. The increased gasoline costs are not unusual. As winter ends and the summer season begins, oil refineries switch production from winter blend to summer blend, which contains supplements, which decreases evaporation." Condi said refinery operations also use the transition time to make repairs and perform maintenance work, and that affects supply, creating a hiccup for the supply chain. AAA reports 1 month ago gas prices for a gallon of regular were $2.94 in the LC Valley. Yesterday, the cost had increased to $4.02 per gallon. Most of the local stations were charging $4.09 by the afternoon. Local health officials have identified one case of measles in Kootenai County. The Kootenai County man spent time in Sacred Heart's emergency room in Spokane when he was infectious. According to the Spokesman Review, other Spokane County people visiting or being treated at Providence Sacred Heart Hospital may have been exposed to measles. Health officials say people coming into the Providence Pediatric and Adult Emergency Departments on Saturday, March 14th, between 12:48 p.m. and 5:52 p.m., and on Sunday, March 15th, between 10:41 a.m. and 4:53 p.m., could have exposed themselves to the measles virus. Measles symptoms include a high fever, runny nose, and a cough similar to a cold. The distinction between other diseases is measles also includes a rash that appears 3 to 5 days following the onset of symptoms. Spokane Regional Health District Officer Dr. Francisco Velasquez said measures can be taken to prevent this disease. Measles is a serious contagious disease, and the message is absolutely critical that if you or your child is not vaccinated, you need to get vaccinated. You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is brought to you in part by One World Cafe, specializing in craft coffee, fresh baked pastries, artisan sandwiches, weekend brunch, wine, beer, and cider on tap. One World Cafe has a web calendar for upcoming live events and a campus location in the Janssen Engineering Building.
KRFP is dedicated to progressive values, including peace and human rights.
Don't touch that dial. You got it right.
We're up in the morning when it first gets light, and we do it all day. Then we're up all night, so you can listen to the radio.
You got it right.
You can listen to the radio. You've got it right.
Listen anytime you listen. Everybody's on a mission, and there ain't nothing missing when you listen to the radio.
Radio,
you got it right.
Community radio.
Listen, you give a little listen to the radio.
Radio Free Moscow.
Fight Back Radio. 90.3 on your radio dial. Fight Back.
Thanks for tuning in. And thanks for your support. So keep on listening and listening and listening.
Fight Back.
We're still here.
Radio. Fight Back.
At 90.3, listener-supported community radio for the Palouse. KRFP, Moscow Pullman.
You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP, Moscow Pullman. An anti-gay censorship bill, Republican Representative Dale Hawkins of Fernwood, that the Senate Education Committee killed last week, has resurfaced with an amendment in the Senate Education Committee. Hawkins' bill would have enacted a total ban on teaching about gender identity and sexual orientation in K through 12 public schools, building on a bill that became law last year that imposed a ban on teaching about gender identity and sexual orientation in grades kindergarten through 3. Yesterday, Republican Senator Cindy Carlson of Riggins introduced the bill again with an amendment that would allow incidental discussion of gender identity and sexual orientation, making the censorship less restrictive.
This is a bill that was in committee last week, and it was held in committee, and I have an amendment that we would like to propose for you. And I'll just read it, unless you have a copy. You have a copy? So my request is that you consider this amendment to the bill to make it a little clearer and that you send it to the amending order. This is per approval of the Superintendent of Public Instruction.
So if you remember, committee, this is the bill that had a strikeout in the last sentence, and there was concern about what that would do as far as being able to implement it in the districts. And this sentence, which you have before you, is meant to replace that strikeout, as I understand, Senator Carlson.
Yes, Chairman. The strikeout would stay in there that is currently in the bill on page 2, lines 21, 22, and 23, and it would add this section below it.
Okay. Thanks for the clarification. Would you like to summarize that for us, Senator?
Sure. The amendment would be the subsection shall not be construed to prohibit incidental reference to such topics within the context of teaching literature, history, biology, health sciences, career technical education, or other academic subjects aligned to state content standards or otherwise permitted by statute.
That was Republican Senator Cindy Carlson of Riggins. Carlson mostly votes with the agenda of the far-right Christian nationalist group, the Idaho Family Policy Center, which is one of the more powerful lobbying groups in the state legislature. According to Investigate West, 2/3 of the Idaho Family Policy Center board members are associated with Moscow's Christian nationalist organization, Christ Church, led by Pastor Doug Wilson. The Idaho Family Policy Center has also written House Bill 557, currently going through the legislature, which would erase all 13 anti-discrimination ordinances in the state that protect gay and lesbian people from discrimination in employment, housing, and public accommodations. those anti-discrimination ordinances were put in place by cities. That bill is aimed at the trans and gay communities because Idaho's overarching anti-discrimination bill protects people from discrimination based on a number of factors, but not gender identity or sexual orientation. A representative of the Idaho Family Policy Center, Grace Howitt, was on hand to support the K-12 public school censorship bill, House Bill 516, choosing to smear secular and progressive perspectives, claiming they mislead children, and raising the specter of what she called radical gender instruction.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Grace Howitt, and I serve as policy analyst at Idaho Family Policy Center. We support House Bill 516, and we thank the sponsor for bringing this bill forward. Schools should never undermine parents by usurping their God-given responsibility to raise their children according to their conscience and the Word of God. Unfortunately, many public schools allow their employees to provide instruction on sexual orientation and gender identity from a progressive or secular perspective that misleads children. Believing that these matters should no longer be discussed in classrooms, the legislature passed House Bill 352 last year with the intention of limiting the prerogative of public school employees to provide students radical gender instruction. That said, schools are interpreting House Bill 352 to allow gender instruction for impressionable children if it is not appropriate according to state standards, which are virtually non-existent. IFPC knows this because we filed public records requests with every Idaho public school district between August 12th and September 11th of last year. We found that only 4 Idaho school districts adopted policies outright prohibiting gender instruction in their schools. Even more concerningly, 35 school districts only prohibit radical gender instruction if it is inappropriate according to state standards. And to make matters worse, most school districts aren't even trying to follow the law. According to our report, 66 school districts did not have any policies that could be interpreted to comply with the requirements laid out in House Bill 352 at the start of the school year, months after the legal deadline for school districts to adopt the policies to comply. And with that in mind, I ask you to ensure that children are not indoctrinated with unbiblical radical gender instruction at school by voting to send House Bill 516 to the 14th order for amendments. And Mr. Chairman, I do have that report that I handed out last time that I would love to give to the committee with your permission.
That was Grace Howitt of the Idaho Family Policy Center. The Senate Education Committee only allowed less than 20 minutes of discussion and public testimony on the bill, which included a complaint from Democratic Senator Carrie Semelroth of Boise that they are not getting input from education professionals or the public on bills like House Bill 516. There was discussion about what would be considered incidental discussion of gender identity or sexual orientation under the public school censorship bill. Here is that committee discussion.
My name is Heather Stout, and I live in Latah County. Now, HB 516 would prohibit classroom instruction on sexual orientation or gender identity from kindergarten through grade 12. I'm a little confused with Senator Carlson's amendment, but I still want to put my testimony forward. Now, the way I understand this bill, it would mean that teachers could not discuss LGBTQ plus history. And she mentioned history, so I might be in order. But it was my understanding that they couldn't discuss that. History, figures, current events, none of that. And even if these topics are relevant to civil rights or the women's rights movement, you couldn't do it. Such restrictions would erase important lessons about people like Pete Buttigieg, Harvey Milk, Alan Turing, and prevent honest conversations about LGBTQ plus families and students. Recognizing these realities is not indoctrination, it's simply telling the truth. I was attending college in San Francisco at the time of Supervisor Harvey Milk and Mayor George Moscone's assassinations. It was a deplorable act of violence aimed at a gay public official, fueled by fear and ignorance. History shows us what happens when people are erased, silenced, or treated as threats simply for who they are. I want my children, I want my grandchildren, and I want all children to know what happened, past and present, So, and to understand the consequences when fear is allowed to grow unchecked. And for those reasons, I implore you to please vote no on HB 516. And thank you so much for letting me speak today.
Thank you. Appreciate you being here. Lori Ballad.
Lori Ballad from Star, Idaho, Chairman Lynn, and members of the Idaho State Education Committee. I'm here to provide a concise overview of House Bill 516. There are 7 points that I'd like you to keep in mind. First is the purpose and scope. 516 aims to clarify and expand the role of parents in public education, seeking greater transparency and partnership while preserving a safe learning environment for students. Two, policy framework and parent involvement. This bill would require districts and public charter schools to adopt an explicit parent involvement policies covering cooperation on homework, attendance, discipline, review of materials, and opt-out mechanisms for certain materials. Number three, information access and notification. It would require timely notice to parents about changes in the student's health and well-being and grant parents access to education and health records, which is usually needed within 5 days. Also, this policy will not prohibit parents or legal guardians from accessing any of their children's education or health records created or maintained or used by the public schools. Four, surveys and public protections. Parental consent would be required for non-curricular surveys that touch on sensitive topics, along with protections for privacy and parents' right to observe school activities. Also, schools must notify parents if a student has been or may be questioned by a school resource officer or law enforcement officer. Number five, complaints and enforcement. A formal process for filing complaints would exist, including the potential for private right of action if the rights are violated. Also, number six, age and developmental appropriate standards. This bill would prohibit classroom instruction on sensitive matters such as sexual orientation or gender identity that are not age relevant and developmentally appropriate under Idaho state standards. And parents, number seven, would have reasonable access to observe all school activities during the school hours. To mention what Senator Cook had questioned on the woman just before me. Oh, shoot. Sorry. I'm a retired teacher. I am going and subbing in West Ada School District. And yes, I have seen it in classrooms. And things were, it's been brought to my attention with the children. We were talking about ducks, and they mentioned that the two different types of ducks, and then starts talking out of the blue about sexual orientation in the classroom. So I have seen it. And also as a teacher, you're usually not going to say things. I was a sub. You're not going to say things when there's a parent there. That's just common sense. Why would you set yourself up?
Okay, well, thank you. Not seeing any questions. I'd like to close. Let us know what your thoughts are on House Bill 516.
Thank you, Chairman. I don't think if this bill, in my opinion, does not take away the ability to teach history on specific individuals. I believe that that is why that is needed to be put in the bill to amend it. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you. Senator Woodward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in that new language proposed for amendment, the wording is prohibit incidental reference. Can you expand upon what is incidental? How should we interpret that?
Senator Carlson.
May I actually refer to whoever wrote this?
Okay.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself, Mr. Taylor.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Doug Taylor. We actually worked with the superintendent's office to craft the language to provide what we felt was clarity around what we intended with the original language. So this was a collaborative effort to come up with that, to find a solution for that. So it was kind of a little bit of back and forth, showing language what we thought would be helpful. So I'm not sure if the superintendent or wants to provide any additional clarity for that, but that's kind of how the process came about.
Mr. Chairman, so I can help this along.
Yeah,
sure.
The process I'm not so interested in, but incidental reference, so to go back to what we heard here, if you're talking about this time in history and you mentioned Harvey Milk and what his orientation was, then is that incidental? And so I just want to understand that. To what extent are we going to consider it incidental?
Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Woodward. I'm not sure I can speak exactly to when we say what is an incidental thing. The point of it was we wanted state boards to adopt, going back to last year's legislation, right, adopt some policies on these matters. The intention was not to omit the ability to have some discussion about historical facts that happened when they come up. That's not the intention. So I think the point of the word incidental is to say we can have these conversations, but we wanted boards to adopt policies to prohibit specifically what was spoken of in House Bill 352. I hope I'm answering that question correctly, or hopefully that's helpful.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're getting to, well, and still I'd just like to hear some examples of what is incidental and what is not.
Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Woodward, I'm not prepared to give examples. I wasn't thinking about that. I thought we kind of had the language sort of crafted where we felt like we were a pathway forward on it. So I'm happy to go and try to provide you some specifics of, I mean, these are some hypotheticals about what's an incidental that we might be referencing. I think the word, in my opinion, the word seems pretty clear what the word is, but.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to interrupt, but can I looked up the word incidental with the Black Law's Legal Dictionary, and it just says relating to something that is less important or is not the main focus.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Woodward.
That's what I think, though, that the hesitation in my mind might be kind of playing out here is that we don't know an example. If we can't easily name examples of incidental, then are teachers going to know what incidental is, and are lawyers going to interpret it the same? That's why I'm wondering if it's clear here for people how they're going to follow this, because what one person considers an incidental reference might be a lot different than someone else. That's what I'm wondering if we're, because yesterday we had, on a different piece of legislation, we had a guarantee we weren't going to court. I'm wondering if we can get that same guarantee today.
Thank you. Senator Carlson, did you have someone else who...
I'll try to jump in here, and maybe the superintendent will have a comment as well. I believe that you could talk about Pete Buttigieg as in the position he was in our government and what gender he has, or how he prefers his gender to be, whatever, or the fact that he's homosexual. That's part of history. I don't believe that's what we're asking them not to teach. Is that consistent? Yeah.
Okay. Any further comments? Sure, Superintendent.
Maybe add a little more, put more question marks above your head, Mr. Chair. Senator Woodward, one of the concerns, I'm going to kind of back into your answer, one of the concerns from the language before was around a book that a teacher had assigned, or a homework assignment, or something where in the classroom a student raises a question, and it wasn't a part of the lesson plan, it wasn't the planned instruction, but as part of the book, and I can't even pull one out of the air, but you know, if you're in a 12th grade English literary class, perhaps the book had been assigned for a long time, and you know, a teacher hadn't paid attention to a side character that had, you know, something to do with, you know, gender identity or sexual orientation as a side character in that book. And so what we were trying to get away from was creating a scenario in a classroom where everything was suspect. And if we're talking in the medical arts, what if we're talking about care for a certain individual? That wasn't the planned instruction of the class, but it's a piece of the information, not specific instruction designed to teach about that.
Okay, thank you.
Does that help or hurt?
Senator Cook?
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Ward-Engelking.
Oh, sorry.
Me? Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the, the effort to get to a place where this works, but I think the part that bothers me is the private cause of action that appears in this bill. I think that is problematic also. It opens the school districts up to lawsuit after lawsuit if somebody feels like there was an incidental mention and it was more than that in their eyes. I just think that's problematic. Teachers will follow the law. They try to do what's right, and I just think this is too much, so that's just my comment.
Thank you. Can I come back to you? Senator Zito's been waiting down here patiently.
Well, I think I can help on the incidental thing. So there's a small school district that has 65% of the kids in the school are ESL. So the teacher assigns a writing assignment on white privilege.
But that's all.
And then that led to the white kids in the classroom being picked on because of white privilege, because of the assignment. So I'm thinking that if there's not a direct connection between the lesson and the topics in this bill, then there wouldn't be a problem. But if it happens to come up in passing, that's a different thing because the teacher doesn't have any control over that. But to make a direct assignment or to bring it up, for the teacher to bring it up in the context of the lesson, I think then you've got an issue. But if it's just incidental, maybe even in the conversation of the kids, it's a different thing. Now, that's the way I understand it.
Thank you. Senator Nichols.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just really quick, I for clarification purposes, this is already current law besides that one section that we're talking about that's being struck out and then just putting in the amendment with it. So everything else is current law that we have already that we've passed. So I just want to make sure, because it sounds like we might get a little confused in what we're actually talking about. And then some of the things, I was just looking up some examples of what incidental, and like I said, incidental is something that's referenced in our law a lot because it just means brief, relevant mentions that arise naturally within a subject without making the topic the focus of instruction. So some things could be like, literature. The character has two moms. The character is struggling with identity. The Stonewall riots were part of civil rights history. Some historical figures had same-sex relationships. Those would, like, where you're just touching on those things and not diving down the rabbit hole and going into all the technicalities of why someone. I think there's one piece of literature out there called The Bluest Eyes, and that references a lot of sexual type stuff in nature. But yeah, it would just be where you're just kind of touching on it instead of making it the main focus.
Thank you. Senator Ward-Engelking.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I probably need to explain my comment a little more. I believe by striking out the sentence, it opens it up to and then adding the new language, it opens it up to interpretation where we could see lawsuits. And that's my comment. I think we're changing the language to be very subjective, and it makes it difficult for people to know what's appropriate and what isn't.
Thank you. I think we probably should wrap this up and get with the rest of our body upstairs. So, Senator, thanks for your presentation, and please join us. Committee, we have House 516 before us for possible action.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Woodward.
Mr. Chairman, I move we send House Bill 516 to the amending order for possible amendment, to the 14th order for possible amendment.
Second.
Been moved and seconded that we send House 516 to the amending order for possible amendments. Any further discussion? Senator Semelroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will support the motion. I would like to make a comment that we have a bill in front of us that is putting curriculum content standards into code, this time by a lobbyist and a successful business owner who I'm sure are very successful in their own right, but they're not educators. They are writing curriculum standards for schools and then putting that into code when we have processes in place that involve content experts and public input. That part has gone away with bills like 516. I will support the amendment and I will support the motion, but I would just like to express my concern on the record.
That was Democratic Senator Kerry Semelroth of Boise. The Senate Education Committee voted unanimously to send the amended bill to the Senate floor. Since the bill has been amended to make the censorship somewhat less restrictive, but also more vague, it would have to pass the Senate and then pass the House again in order to be sent to the governor. The head of the National Counterterrorism Center has resigned in a protest over the war in Iran. Joe Kent, an Army veteran and former congressional candidate from southwestern Washington, resigned from his post as the Trump administration's top counterterrorism official Tuesday. Kent said when he resigned earlier this week, "I cannot in good conscience support the ongoing war in Iran. Iran posed no imminent threat to our nation, and it is clear that we started this war due to pressure from Israel and its powerful American lobby." Kent ran two unsuccessful congressional campaigns in Washington as a Republican and Trump loyalist. In his first race in 2022, Kent, who lived in Clark County, beat incumbent Republican U.S. Representative Jamie Herrera Butler in the primary. Kent lost to Democratic U.S. Representative Marie Glusenkamp Perez. Kent lost again to Glusenkamp Perez in 2024. In his resignation letter posted on social media, Kent said he had supported President Donald Trump's America First foreign policy agenda. Kent wrote, "Until June of 2025, you understood that the wars in the Middle East were a trap that robbed America of the precious lives of our patriots and depleted the wealth and prosperity of our nation." In response to Kent's resignation, Trump said, "I didn't know him well, but I thought he seemed like a pretty nice guy. But when I read his statement, I realized that it's a good thing that he's out because he said that Iran was not a threat. Iran was a threat to every country." The Senate confirmed Kent in July as director of the National Counterterrorism Center. In his role, Kent oversaw a staff of more than 1,000 people and reported to the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard. The government established the National Counterterrorism Center in the wake of the September 11, 2001 attacks. His resignation took effect immediately. At the time, both Democratic U.S. senators from Washington opposed Kent's nomination for director of the National Counterterrorism Center. In July of last year, Senator Patty Murray called him patently unqualified. On social media Tuesday, Senator Murray said, "Good riddance to Joe Kent, a disgraceful white supremacist, but that's a major public admission that there was no justification for this war." Trump nominated Kent as director of the National Counterterrorism Center in February 2025. The Senate confirmed him to the position in July by a vote of 52-44 without Democratic support. Ahead of Kent's confirmation, numerous reports detailed his associations with extremist figures, including far-right extremist groups, the Proud Boys, and Patriot Prayer. Washington Governor Bob Ferguson has signed a bill that forbids law enforcement officers from wearing face coverings while on duty, with certain exceptions. Senate Bill 5855 was in response to federal ICE agents, which are considered law enforcement officers despite their minimal training, terrorizing communities while attempting to snatch immigrants that have been deemed illegal, some of whom came to the U.S. legally but have since been declared illegal by the Trump administration. ICE agents have killed immigrants and non-immigrants in U.S. cities so far this year. The governor trekked to El Centro de la Raza, which is the hub for the local Latino community in South Seattle, to sign the bill. Seattle Mayor Katie Wilson was on hand. The bill has exceptions for SWAT teams, personal protective equipment, and face coverings worn for religious purposes. It also would allow people that police detain while violating the law to file litigation against the police force. No Republicans in the Washington legislature voted for the bill. Republican lawmakers claim the bill is unconstitutional because the Supremacy Clause of the U.S. Constitution says federal law takes precedence over state law. Observers say Washington's new law has a better chance to withstand a court challenge than California's law prohibiting masks on federal law enforcement. That law was struck down. Washington's law includes state and local police in the ban on wearing masks. Governor Ferguson said a legal challenge to the new law is inevitable. He said, "The one thing I know is when the Attorney General's office in Washington state defends laws that we do related to the federal government, we win just about every single time. I'm confident, and we did our best to structure it in a way that is defensible." And you're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Friends of the Clearwater, a 501c3 environmental nonprofit dedicated to protecting your public lands. FOC is defending the wildlands, wildlife, and waterways of north central Idaho for future generations. Friendsoftheclearwater.org.
Nampa Mayor Rick Hogeboom died Wednesday night shortly after collapsing while speaking at a regional forum for Treasure Valley mayors at Eagle City Hall. Eagle Mayor Brad Pike was sitting next to Hogeboom as he spoke about 45 minutes into the meeting, which had begun at 6 p.m. Pike told the Idaho Press Hogeboom's speech began to slur and then he fell towards him. Pike, who is a former firefighter, began administering CPR. Police cleared the room so arriving paramedics could work. The Ada County Coroner's Office said later that evening Hogeboom died due to cardiac tamponade, which according to the National Institutes of Health is a medical emergency that takes place when abnormal amounts of fluid accumulate in the pericardial sac, compressing the heart and leading to a decrease in cardiac output and shock. Caldwell Mayor Eric Phillips, who was scheduled to speak at the forum, said he arrived shortly before the emergency, and he said as a policeman he can tell when paramedics realize nothing is working. And then he suddenly felt like he had been punched in the chest and got dizzy and lightheaded. He ended up on the ground. He said he was briefly unconscious and then agreed to be transported to the hospital as a precaution. Hogeboom was 47 years old and had just been sworn in for his first term as mayor in January. He served on the Nampa City Council from 2017 to 2020 and then worked as chief of staff for Mayor Debbie Kling. Hogeboom had been a pastor, a member of the Idaho Press editorial board, a youth sports coach, and the founder of The Nesting Place, a home for expecting mothers. He's survived by his wife Mimi and five offspring and a grandchild. In an emergency meeting yesterday, the Nampa City Council passed a resolution appointing City Council President David Bills to serve as interim mayor for up to 90 days or until they can choose a mayor to serve until the next municipal election in November 2027, whichever comes first. A St. Mary's man died in a crash with a semi-truck on State Highway 3 north of the city. According to the spokesman review, a 65-year-old St. Mary's resident was driving a 2025 Toyota Tacoma north on State Highway 3 when he lost control of the truck on a curve and crossed the center line and struck a southbound semi-truck driven by a 48-year-old St. Regis, Montana man. Emergency responders pronounced the unidentified Toyota driver dead at the scene. According to the Benoit County Sheriff's Office, the highway was blocked for about 2.5 hours. An investigation into the accident is ongoing.
KRFP is sponsored by Mikey's Euros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine, such as Euros, falafel, hummus, and tabbouleh. Located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
KRFP is also sponsored by
Hodgins Drug and Hobby of 307 South Main Street in Moscow. Hodgins features a pharmacy, educational toys, and hobbies. Hodgins also sells and services hearing aids. You can call Hodgins at 208-882-5536. KRFP supports progressive values, including multiculturalism and environmentalism.
Tune into Live on KEXP. Exclusive live performances recorded in the shadow of the Space Needle. On the show next time, from Bogota, Colombia, the birthplace of cumbia, it's the energetic joy of Frente Cumbiero. It's one-of-a-kind sessions from your favorite artists and from a few you're about to discover. From our studios in Seattle, it's Live on KEXP.
Coming up Saturday at 3:30 p.m.
How do you encase the values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, environmentalism, and freedom of expression into sausage-based messaging?
Well, you could grind it together and use it in biodegradable wrapper and tie off each end.
Yeah, and have the sausage bring you progressive radio.
Does the sausage transmit radio waves from my tummy to my brain?
Well, if you buy progressive sausage at the KRFP meet and greet, that sausage's proceeds go directly towards Radio Free Moscow, bringing you local progressive radio. That's right, KRFP is now part of Shattuck West Brewing's new series of meet and greets, hosted by Happy Hog Meadery. Get it? Meet and greet.
All food sales and monetary donations will benefit KRFP, your non-profit, non-commercial community radio station. Plus, the Shattuck West Tap Room will donate $1 for each beverage sold to KRFP.
March 24th, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Shattuck West, 630 North Almond Street.
That's Tuesday, March 24th, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Shattuck West, 630 North Almond Street.
And you're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report Extended Friday Edition. We now turn to our featured segment. On Saturday of last week, Paradise Creek in Moscow flooded with a stage of 11.54 feet, which is the highest stage measured since the city began measuring this creek's water level 47 years ago. By coincidence, Saturday's highest flooding of Paradise Creek occurred 2 days before the city council meeting with the city's Paradise Creek maintenance plan on the agenda. The city council's public works committee had recommended the city approve the plan the week before, and the city council voted unanimously to approve the plan Monday night this week. Part of the reason for the plan is the city must comply with a number of rules pertaining to the creek, including state discharge permit rules, because the creek is designated as the city's stormwater conveyance system. We now bring you Deputy City Administrator Tyler Palmer's presentation to the Moscow City Council on Monday night.
All right, last up here for regular items on the agenda, we have Paradise Maintenance Creek Program Plan with Tyler Palmer. Thanks for being here, Tyler. Thanks, Chief.
Welcome, Your Honor. Council, happy to be here this evening to discuss something that became all the more pertinent over the course of the weekend. This is rather timely, especially considering how long we've been working on this plan. As I think everybody's aware, we saw record rainfall and record flooding over the course of the weekend. And I think it just highlights the necessity for us to take a more proactive approach with our creek maintenance. Paradise Creek is our primary drainage facility that goes through the city. One of the dictates of the council is we were listed as an MS4 under the NPDES permit, so a federal permit for our stormwater system, was that we use that opportunity to prop up a utility and proactively maintain our storm sewer system, which is something that really hadn't happened. It'd been entirely reactively maintained, largely just due to lack of resources to maintain it proactively. And so just a little background on this, recognition of kind of the reason that how we got to where we got to here tonight. This is the top 20 historic crests on Paradise Creek that you're looking at here. The gauge, the USGS gauge that's located on Perimeter Drive in the highway, began reads in 1979. And so it's a 47-year history that we have on Paradise Creek. And the thing that I'd like to point out from this chart is we've got this color-coded where you can see that in the lighter color, that represents all of the crests that we've seen in the last 10 years. So of the 20 top crests in the 47-year history of this gauge, you can see how many of them have occurred in the last 10 years. And you'll also notice that 5 of the 6 highest in history have occurred in the last 10 years. This is a pattern that we're seeing. It's a pattern that we've been seeing with a lot of the climate change that we've experienced, that we're seeing less snowpack over the course of the winter. We're seeing we see about the same amount of precipitation, but a lot more of that is coming as rainfall in the spring. When I got to the city of Moscow in 2009, the institutional knowledge that was passed along to me was that a large flood was not possible without snow and ice, that a purely hydraulic event could not generate a large flood on Paradise Creek. In 2012, we saw for the first time that that wasn't true. We were all very surprised to see a spring event that came in and kept going up, and that was this 2012 event that you can see right here that reached 10 feet. So in response to the 2019 event, which is right here, our second highest event that we've had, the city sought and was granted a hazard mitigation grant. And with that hazard mitigation grant, we took a hard look at Paradise Creek to say, okay, what can we do? What are the alternatives? Is there infrastructure that we can build that will help remediate the flooding? Are there activities that we can engage in we can try to mitigate some of the impacts and ameliorate the impacts that we see from these high water events? In summary, the plan made some recommendations. We came away with a good model of the creek. They went through with LIDAR, and we got good elevations and a good model of the creek so we could better understand it, what was flowing. It's a relatively flat creek. We've got about 19 miles that it flows basically from the mountain through Moscow until it joins the Palouse River. And it can move a lot of sediment. It's relatively flat, and it comes quick off the mountain. And so really, it's one of the most reactive creeks in the Northwest. It really comes up quickly, and we saw that the other night. It does not take much for that creek to really come up, and so it can because of that, it can move a lot of sediment. We saw that with the underpass project the city had proposed to go under US 95, where a lot of that work happened prior to the 2019 flood and a lot of the planning work, and it looked like that was going to be possible. Along comes the 2019 flood and brings in a foot and a half of sediment that just gets redeposited. And so there's a lot of sediment that moves within that creek. Unfortunately, there was no silver bullet that came out of the hazard mitigation study. There wasn't the one thing that they're like, yeah, you've got, acquire this land and build a big old reservoir and you can easily divert the water. That didn't come out of it. And so what we were left with was a recognition that we really have to deal with what we've got and be realistic about what we've got. And the creek channel is one of the main things that we can do a lot of work in. And so Paradise Creek, as I mentioned, 19 miles, throughout flows through the city. It's absolutely critical for our stormwater conveyance. The creek is included in our MS4 permit and our IPDS permit, so it is part of our stormwater conveyance system. It's important for water quality protection, for flood mitigation, for wildlife habitat, and it is an impaired water body under the 303D. It has total maximum daily load requirements on that body of water. There's a lot of regulatory drivers, as I'd indicated. We have our permit. We have compliance with the Clean Water Act. We have the IDEQ total maximum daily load implementation. There's Section 404 permits that can be applicable. And without getting into a whole bunch of government acronyms and nomenclature, the point of the matter is there's a lot of rules that we've got to keep as they pertain to the creek. And so we've generated this plan. In looking at this, as we knew we needed to have a more active plan for Paradise Creek, it's complicated because the city doesn't own the ground under Paradise Creek for much of the creek as it flows through town. As anybody who lives in proximity to the creek saw over the course of the weekend, there's a lot of residences that are built in close proximity to the creek. So access is a really big challenge. And so it's something that with no resources and no ability to really tackle this, nobody had really tackled, okay, how do we long-term plan for the creek? How do we do active routine creek maintenance? And it's a pretty Herculean task. And so we knew that when we got the results from the study, we really needed to dive in, and it was time to bite the bullet. And with the stormwater utility in place, which was always the plan that with the initial permit of the stormwater utility, we would be doing reconnaissance. We got staff out cleaning lines, cameraing lines, inspecting so that we can start to generate a capital plan, know what we've got so that we can make a good plan for what's coming forward, and try and capture those needs. So the plan establishes a formal framework for routine maintenance. So things like post-storm monthly, annual inspections of the creek. And it also separates the creek into 15 segments. And these 15 segments allow us, to have some logical termini for different conditions on the creek. Places where, for example, Heron's Hideout might be one section where it's a section where we have access. It's fairly wide. It's a section where we can let wildlife kind of really take full reins there. Beavers can build dams and it can spread out and there's room for that. And it's great for the creek and it's great for the health. But then we have other sections where it's going through a bunch of backyards and we don't own the property and we don't have access. And so there's just different challenges. And so it separates it into 15 segments. Another critical component of this plan is a beaver management policy. That's something that the city really takes seriously, is trying to coexist with beavers on the creek. They predate us here and they can play a really critical role. And so we want to make sure that we have a good plan for how we interact with beavers in the creek. It also includes things like site access planning and then public education and stewardship. So incorporating this into our public outreach programs, helping educate people about the importance of the creek and how to interact with the creek. So the routine maintenance structure, post-storm, so after every storm, we go out and we do a debris inspection, we do erosion checks, check the infrastructure. Monthly, we do culvert inspections, minor sediment removal, and vegetation management. And then annually, it's a more comprehensive assessment, a sediment survey, major vegetation and channel work is what we want to work toward with this. We want to be able to tackle sections and conduct the work necessary within that section. And I'll get into a little bit more details on that as we move forward. These are the sections that you can see here that we've divided the creek into in this plan. And then we've got projects that are prioritized based on risk and conditions. So, each one of these, some of these areas have far fewer impacts if they flood or if there are issues than other sections. And so we wanted to make sure that we had a plan that allowed us in a very logical and rational way to identify the priorities. And it's also a little complicated because it's great. It all flows. And so if you do, this section here, that water can move in a less obstructed manner, it's just hitting that section there. And so we got to make sure that those are planned out, staged out accordingly so that we don't have a situation where it's like, oh, well, we fixed problem A, but now we've created problems B, C, and D downstream. And so we want to be very careful with that. It's not going to be cheap. This is not a cheap endeavor. These are estimates. We'll certainly be able to refine these numbers, especially after we get through the first round of creek maintenance projects. This is the first time this is going to have happened. The last significant creek shaping project took place, I think, in 2004. It's been a long time. It's been a long time, and there's been a really evolving regulatory climate as it pertains to these type of projects. You'll notice that there's some pretty huge variation between some of these sections when it comes to cost. And that really just reflects the level of complication and the level of treatment necessary. Some of these need us to get in there with equipment, reshape the banks, fortify the banks in certain places, revegetate, and all that has to be done where there isn't existing access. And so that means that we've got to spend the time to coordinate with property owners, acquire easements, potentially acquire rights of way, determine how we can get debris in and debris out. It's not just a matter of, you know, dropping a bulldozer in the creek and letting it run wild. Like we're going to be removing a lot of materials in some cases, bringing materials in other cases. And so we have to really plan out on a pretty defined level. How are we getting in? Where do we need to get out? How much do we need to get out? And really make sure that there's a lot of planning in advance. And that's going to then require a lot of coordination with the folks that are in the neighborhood, in the area where that work has to happen. So it's not an insignificant lift for this. But it's a process that we're excited to get started on because we recognize the necessity, especially in the wake of that 2019 hazard mitigation plan, demonstrating that there really just isn't another option. We can't just retain the water upstream of the city and then slowly release it. That's not an option. So we've got to make sure that we're engaging with this. The structure that is in this plan lays out projects from 2027 to 2041. We will be bringing a utility rate study to the council in the next cycle. And what's reflected in the recommendations from staff and from that committee is stretching these projects out into every other year, trying to conduct a project, which both staff and the rate committee thought was appropriate, one, to ameliorate the rate impacts on storm. Storm is a small utility, and so the rate, the dollar amount doesn't inflate a lot, but on a percentage basis, it can rather significantly as we start to introduce some of these capital needs. And with the complication of a lot of these projects, realistically, we weren't going to be able to, in all likelihood, do one annually anyway. There's going to be a high level of planning that's necessary, especially with this first round. The thing that we're excited about is once we've gone through this first time, we'll have built a playbook. We'll have acquired the easements. Well, the people who follow us will have a lot easier time with this than we're going to have this first time going through. The beaver management policy, I'd like to touch on some of the protocol for the beaver management policy. There's monitoring protocols. We identify sections of the creek where it is absolutely appropriate for beavers to be, for them to build, for them to basically engage undeterred with the environment around them. But then there are other areas where it's really problematic and that we have to identify where those problematic areas are. And then we have a series of options for dealing with beavers as it progresses through the plan. So we have a lot of non-lethal deterrence options. You know, a lot of the things that we'll hear from people is just like they're taking down critical trees and we have deterrence. We have deterrence measures for that. Or there might be a dam that there are concerns about some of the upstream and downstream impacts of a dam. And there are options for example, putting in a pond leveler. And we've done some experimentation on some private property with that, with installing pond levelers. And so there's different approaches, and those are all laid out in the plan, the different BMPs that we can use, the best management practices. There's emergency dam breaching standards that are included in this. And also coordination with Idaho Fish and Game. That's the oversight agency that we have to interact with when we're dealing with beavers in the creek. You wouldn't think it was such a complicated thing, but it really is. And there's a lot of emotions around beavers, and so it's something that we really want to make sure that we can clearly articulate why we do what we do and what approach we're taking, and also so that we can be consistent, so that it's not going to vary based on whether an employee's got a 22 and is really excited or not or something. Like, this is not any approach that we want to take. Not that that's ever how we'd go about that, but Yeah, we want to make sure that it's all by the book, and we can clearly articulate how we deal with that.
Tyler, just real quick, I know you mentioned it last week. I've already forgotten. How many beaver families do we have approximately?
We estimate that there are probably somewhere around 10 to 12 dens, with anywhere from 4 to 6 beavers per den. And so, yeah, there's quite a few that are out. We have some really good spots for them, and there's several areas where they're really beneficial. That they really help out. There's some other places they really love to be that they aren't as beneficial, and we've got to encourage them to move along. But yeah, so about that.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay, so the benefits of this entire plan of the city is, one, it just improves our MS4 regulatory compliance. It's going to reduce emergency maintenance costs, improve flood resilience. As you saw in that flood chart, this is not going to eliminate flooding. There's nothing we can do about that. There's only the capacity of the creek is the capacity of the creek, and it's just math. That's just engineering and hydraulics. That's just how it's going to happen. But we hope to be able to have that be far more predictable and make sure that we are minimizing those impacts to the maximum extent that we can. It also supports grant competitiveness and provides a clear capital roadmap so that we can really start that transition toward proactive maintenance of this facility that's so critical for the city's future. So the staff recommendation is that the council adopt the creek maintenance program. And with that, I would be happy to stand for any questions you might have.
You're listening to Moscow Deputy City Administrator Tyler Palmer speaking to the City Council about the proposed Paradise Creek maintenance plan at Monday night's City Council meeting. The council eventually voted to approve the plan. We'll be back with City Council discussion with Tyler Palmer after this break.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and Rembrandt Tree Care, family owned and operated since 1977. A conscientious approach to urban forestry with year-round tree service on the Palouse and surrounding areas. You can reach Rembrandt Tree Care at 509-330-0699.
KRFP thanks all of its donors and underwriters for helping make this programming possible.
We now continue with Deputy City Administrator Tyler Palmer's presentation to the Moscow City Council Monday night on the new Paradise Creek maintenance plan. Later in the meeting, the City Council voted unanimously to approve the plan.
All right, questions? Yeah, Sage.
I have several questions, so I don't want to interrupt others full of questions if they've got them, but I'll just start with saying thank you so much for this information. Personally, I'm a property owner with 2 properties within a block of the creek, one of which is adjacent. And so I am particularly personally interested in this. Climate change has brought us here, right? Those major flood events. I don't know if that's any coincidence. I think that's common in communities over the last 10 to 20 years. And unfortunately flooding on the Palouse, if there's to be a natural disaster, this is the one to worry about. It has been, and it will continue to be. And so just to kind of bring weight to this issue, I think, we need to be frank about it, that this is a big deal. My first question for you, Tyler, there is mention several times throughout the plan about kind of owner involvement, owner maintenance. What exactly do you recommend that best look like? Is that, people getting, for example, if someone gets a submersible pump, expecting to redirect water during a flood event, not going to happen. Major water is going to flow where it wants. People want to cut down a tree or trap beavers or that sort of thing. What do you think is the best sort of local resource for owners in managing these events proactively as well as reactively?
That's a really good question, Counselor. And I think one of the things that our staff is excited about with this plan, but will also be a big challenge of this plan, is that there's not a one size fits all because of the way that it's developed around the creek. If we developed with no properties within 20 yards either side and we had an access road that went right up the side and I could just roll a piece of equipment right up through there, it would be a different story. But we've got ownership and people right up on the creek. And so inherent in the nature of the challenge is going to be there's not going to be a machete that we've got to do this with. It's going to be a scalpel. And so each one of these areas is going to have different things that may be asked, or that it's going to require a lot of cooperation. It's not something that we don't have the tool to just go out there and say, here it is, and this is what we're doing, because in many cases we don't have the access. It's going to require cooperation, and it's going to require a lot of coordination. There are some universals, things like don't throw trash in the creek, you know, things like that's, it's not a dumping ground. There's going to be some landscape maintenance and recommendations that come out of that about how you build next to the creek and what's appropriate and what's not, and what might just be a problem that gets washed downstream, et cetera. So there'll be some things that we can apply with a broader brush, but then there will be a lot of just direct community interaction that'll have to be very custom and specific to the specific stretch of creek. I'm sorry, it's a pretty vague answer, but I'm afraid I don't have more definition than that until we actually dive into each of these sections.
Okay, to kind of build on that, so I notice several of the sections are kind of earmarked as, you know, mostly private landowners versus public landowners. In terms of the notification to the public surrounding the specific sections as work is being done, what should people sort of expect prior?
Yeah, I think that what really people can expect prior is maybe an overload of communication. I would anticipate community meetings specific to those sections of creek, especially the ones where we're going to need easements and access and right-of-way and those types of things. So specific community meetings, typically we try and hold those in a place that's easy for people to get to. So it will be flyers, it will be social media notification, it will be mailers, it will be in-person community meetings where we put out a map. It likely will involve walking the creek with different property owners or anyone who wants to, and just doing a walking tour, talking through the things that we want to do. And then as we generate a plan and get closer to construction, then there will be an even further ramp up in communication about schedules and timing and impact and what people might see. And so it is going to require a lot of communication and a lot of coordination with those local folks. And so it'll be very hands-on as we get into the actual project planning processes.
Okay. Thank you. And I have one more. Sorry to keep going. So this is quite obviously a giant man-made revision to this creek. Has there been a prior project like this for Paradise Creek to your knowledge?
There have. Over time, we've been able to find several different projects that the city had engaged in over time. I think it was largely reactive, or, you know, a grant would become available. And so we've been able to find a few where the city has gone in and done just reshaping, trying to reestablish what would be an appropriate profile, armoring, et cetera. So there have been projects over time. I believe the last one was 2004. It might have been 2001, but I think it was 2004 was the last project of any significance of this type.
Okay. Thank you, Tyler.
Tyler, when you talked to the committee, you also touched a little bit about the creek doesn't end at the border. And so what kind of talks and works are going on with Whitman County at this point?
We have had coordination with Whitman County. You know, the elevation kind of is what the elevation is, and it certainly is less restricted as you get out to the state line. One of the biggest points of coordination that we have is that we have had a family of beavers that likes to be just across the Washington line, and where their pool backs up gets into our discharge area from the water reclamation facility. And we have certain measuring equipment that actually has to get critical measurements for our compliance for our permit, that is reliant on that flowing out of the pipe and not being in a pipe that's submerged. And so that's a point of coordination that we've had to have, is just on that activity primarily. That's been the main point of coordination. Certainly as we move forward with this plan and with coordination, we'll continue with our coordination with Whitman County. We coordinate with them on a lot of cross-border aspects like Paradise Path and all those things. This will primarily impact really just the Moscow stretch, but there will be some points of coordination.
Thank you. Scott, down.
Sure. Couple questions. Development, we got some emails and some people asked questions about like development on the outside of town. And do you really see that as any, have any significance to the amount of flooding or the flooding that we've been experiencing?
You know, really, I can understand the perception. You know, we've had a lot of conversations, for example, with this most recent storm, where we had people that were absolutely convinced that their sewers were backed up, for example, because they hadn't seen water flow into their basement before. And the sewers weren't backed up. It's just, you haven't seen it before because we've never had that much rain in that short a period. And we've never had water this high on ground that was already saturated. And so it was just, that's the water got in. And so that unprecedented thing, I think often is easy to tie to the most visible thing. And sometimes development's the most visible thing. I'm not saying that development could never have an impact, but there are requirements for development, for detention. Those calculations are generated by professional engineers, reviewed by our professional engineers. And so generally, we've got a pretty high level of confidence that as development is coming in, they are being required to detain water at the pre-development rate. And so it's a rate that should not contribute to flooding in any way that the bare ground that was there before had contributed to any sort of flooding that we had. Does that answer your question?
Yep. I have a few more. Some of the things, just talking to people, I'm not advocating for this one. I'm just saying it, just let you know. Colfax made a giant concrete channel. Was there ever any consideration, because it's so flat and the cost implications? I mean, we're going to be cleaning this out for the next, say, 5 years, and we're probably going to turn around and be doing it for the next 5 years and the next 5 years. Is there any consideration of either sections or other considerations of channeling? Or
as we get into the specific planning for each of these sections, I don't know what that'll look like. I don't know what recommendations will come out of that. I can tell you that the $5 million estimate to complete this project, and that's, you know, we're looking at every other year, 15 segments, a 30-year project every other year. And then we would just analyze how long it holds up and see if we're coming back to section one again and continuing, would absolutely blow that estimate out of the water. We couldn't get one of these sections. It would not even be close. We would be talking about hundreds of millions of dollars to try and complete a project like that. And then that's if we could get a permit. I sincerely doubt that is something that with the regulations currently in place, I would be very doubtful that there would be any chance of getting a permit to make a concrete channel throughout the city, or even for any significant chunk of the city.
Okay. Just wanted to preface it. That's just what I heard. Okay, want to bring it up?
Asking for a friend.
Last one for the five. I think it was like $4.4 or $5 million you had there. The funding is. I know in the previous where we spoke, the stormwater fund is continuing to increase based on our fees. Is this funding that's coming out of the stormwater fund that we're acquiring right now?
This funding is not coming out of this. We are not accumulating funds from the stormwater utility that are adequate to cover this activity. This activity is anticipated in the upcoming rate study that will come before the council in the next council cycle. So it'll be coming to committee on the 23rd, and then we anticipate that going to council on April 6th, depending on how the interaction at committee goes. It is anticipated in that rate study. So the rates that are reflected, that are being proposed, and that have been reviewed by the Citizen Rate Committee and recommended reflect this activity, but they reflect this activity on an every other year basis.
Yeah, Evan.
Thanks for the presentation. It's all very relevant, very necessary, needed. I don't think there's any doubt we'll want you to proceed with the plan. My question is, how long you think it will take you to do the initial surveying and assessment to really determine what needs are and what the priorities are? Do you have an idea? Because right now you don't have people and funding technically to do that. So with the plan, we can in fiscal year 27 do the funding, and then you can actually give us an idea of, but do you know how long even it'll take you to come up with a firm idea of what's needed?
If the council decides to adopt what's being proposed in the rate study, and in FY27 we start to accumulate funds toward this, that will allow us to start generating capital toward a project. At that point, we would start on the first prioritized segment and start planning. And so that would immediately start that planning within that FY27 budget year. So our goal would be to have planning that public outreach and design started in FY27, potentially looking for a project in FY28, FY29 would be the goal, to get that first project kicked off within, you know, just depending on how long. There's a lot of unknowns, how long the public interaction process is going to take, how long if we have to acquire easements. There's a lot of that out there, but we don't plan to delay implementation. If the council adopts this plan and then adopts the rates that would support this plan, then we plan on starting.
Another thing, because it's an impaired water body, do we have a sense of which of the impairments, and there's several, that really we will prioritize, or will that also be different from segment to segment? I know right away that infrastructure is going to be the top, protecting the water treatment plant and bridges.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, are we looking at sediment mostly, debris removal? Do you have a sense of what the priority might be?
This plan is largely focused on sediment and debris, and anything that would obstruct the flow. Much of the other impairments, like phosphorus, for example, in Paradise Creek, those are dealt with through our permit largely. There are aspects to this plan, you know, things like revegetation in areas and appropriate vegetation in areas that can help with those things, certainly. But this, our primary focus with this plan is really just the hydraulics of the creek, making sure that it's flowing as is appropriate.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions?
All right, well, No, it's not a public hearing, and so we'd be happy to stick around and talk afterwards, but we're just reviewing the plan, and with that, I'm looking for action.
Sandra already made a motion.
Should I just follow up on that? Thanks, Evan. Now I move that we adopt Paradise Creek Maintenance Program Plan.
And I'll second that.
All right.
Scott.
I have a question before. Right. So if we're adopting this, but we're also going to be voting in 2 weeks or in the next council for the funding, this is just the plan, but we're not necessarily.
I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you, Counselor. This, you're not authorizing funds with this. And even with the rate study, you're authorizing us to collect rates that would be in accordance with the plan. But annually through the budgeting process, council will appropriate funds. And so that'll be an annual process. A current council can't dictate what a future council will do as far as funding goes in that regard. And so each year we will bring forth a funding package, just like we do with all the other processes of the city and the utilities and the capital plan. Each year we bring a capital budget that is adopted by the council annually. And so the council will have an opportunity to review annually the program and determine if it's something that they want to continue to fund.
No, it's a good question. Yeah. All right. With that, we'll start with Scott. Scott.
Aye.
Sage.
Aye.
Sandra.
Aye.
Evan.
Aye.
And Drew is an aye. So, all right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a presentation by Deputy Moscow City Administrator Tyler Palmer at Monday night's Moscow City Council meeting on the Paradise Creek Maintenance Plan, which you just heard that the City Council approved unanimously, although funding will come up during another City Council agenda item in the future. Palmer says the project will cost an estimated $5 million over several years as money becomes available. He estimates there are between 10 and 12 beaver dams on Paradise Creek within the city limits, with 4 to 6 beavers each. Palmer said it could cost up to $5 million to implement the plan, and the vote by the City Council Monday night was to accept the plan but not allocate money. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, 60% chance of rain tomorrow, mainly before 8 a.m. Snow level 5,800 feet, lowering to 3,900 feet in the afternoon. Cloudy through mid-morning, then gradual clearing, high 51. West winds 10 to 15, gusts up to 25. Mostly clear Saturday night, low 31. Increasing cloud Sunday, high 50. Mostly cloudy, low 34 Sunday night. And mostly cloudy Monday and Monday night, high 54, low 39. 50% chance of rain Tuesday, cloudy high 53. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events, and the public affairs shows, you can become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 and for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Brenda Cox and Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman Community Radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
Extinction Rebellion Palouse proudly supports KRFP. XR Palouse is organizing to have our governments and institutions declare a climate emergency, achieve climate justice and biodiversity, and leverage the power of arts and humanities to foster social change. KRFP is dedicated to progressive values, including justice and multiculturalism.